Welcome to the podcast, Dave DeGaulle.
Hey, Alan, how you doing? Great to be back with you.
And it's great to be with you. And I just wanted to take our listeners on a journey of Enterprise Web and where you guys got started and what you discovered along the way and what you're doing now with generative AI and related techniques.
Yeah, well, that's quite a scoop.
It's been quite
a journey, of our own, but also a journey, obviously, not in a vacuum as the industry was evolving too, right? So it's been an interesting time. And actually, I've had the pleasure of spending a good deal, almost a decade probably with you, having conversations over much of this period, this era. But Enterprise Web actually started, if we go back, all the way back, as an idea, right? And the idea was, my career was starting, turning around and growing companies. And around the turn of the century, I started to recognize that the technologies, the way we were doing things in the past, weren't going to serve what was obviously going to be a more distributed future. So, remember, and it's like, everything seems obvious to us today for what exists, but remember, the cloud didn't really take off till like 2012, right? Microservices didn't really start to like 2016 in any kind of way, right? And so you could already see in the early mid 2000s during the REST and SOA wars, which is when we met, right? I think it was mm-hmm. around the time to probably 2005, 2006, seven. Oh no, it was probably a little later than that when we met, but that was when REST versus SOA sort of was going on. And I was looking at the problems of sort of business agility, business transformation, transparency over operations, control over operations, automation. And my thesis was back then, and still is today, that essentially that the stack is the enemy of agility, right? That we had, at some point, we had mainframes and everything lived unified in a mainframe of zeros and ones. Then we had distributed computing came along, and we started then having component architectures and distributed component architectures. And then we started wiring these stacks together for different use cases. And we found a way to essentially build software from components, which gave us some modularity and some flexibility and some distribution. But those stacks then became tightly coupled together themselves, somewhat monolithically, and their applications were tightly coupled to them. And they really resisted change. And of course, an enterprise wasn't just one stack. It was dozens or hundreds of these stacks, each stack representing a different set of components, maybe a different set of different versions of different components. And even if those components were ostensibly built on standards, there was no meaningful interoperability across those stacks. So before I fast forward to 2023, and the greatest challenge for the enterprise, over a decade later, 15 years later, is still end-to-end anything, right? End-to-end integration, end-to-end automation, right? End-to-end transparency, end-to-end governance. Those are the problems. So when you think of when I came up with the idea of the company, Enterprise Web, the idea was, as a business guy, which I was and I am, as a business guy, I wanted a view down, looking down on my enterprise. I wanted a web, right? I wanted to be able to look down on my business from a certain perspective and see all the elements that were constructing it. I wanted to see the organizational units. I wanted to see the capabilities. I wanted to see the information down into the sources. And I wanted to look at them. Ultimately, when I was developing the company, it was like, okay, this has to be done by a graph, right? I need a graph. I need this. Enterprise Web is going to be a graph. It just made sense. Because I recognized early on that the organizations aren't really strict hierarchies, right? Organizations are these complex assemblies of units. And of course, even if you just start with organizational units, even those can be a big mess, right? Because they like to make them hierarchical, but often organizational units have extra hierarchical units. You have units that have multiple parents. You have people that are connected to one or more units. So you end up having this sort of complex relationships at the level of organizational units, at the level of information and capabilities. and people. And you want to represent that richly because that's actually the real world, right? And that's what graphs do really well, is they model real world complexity in a way that sort of hierarchical information models do not. So that's just a premise. Does that make sense, Alan?
It makes a lot of sense. And so you've got this end-to-end challenge that you started with, and it makes all the sense in the world that you used a graph approach to try to address that situation. So you're modeling the enterprise at a certain level of abstraction. And so how are you managing that model?
That's a great question, right? And because historically there's been a trade-off between modeling, the time to do take to do invest in models versus the time to just be tactical and just code, hard code everything, right? So you have really two choices. You're going to be imperative and statically coded, right? Opaque, rigid, right? All those things, right? Or you can be transparent, right? In models, that's the whole value proposition of a model, is that you're making your logic transparent, right? In imperative coding, in imperative hard code, right? In traditional software development, which is still done today, right? There is a model, but it's implicit, right? It's not transparent to the user, right? And the idea was, God, why can't we break this all this business logic down, make this fully declarative, so that I can have my logic on top of my elements, and then I can have a lot of loosely coupled elements, people, information, and capabilities that I can flexibly compose for events based on policies. And the idea was to create graphs that would A, expedite the modeling of the domain itself, right? That'd be that. So that was one thing, right? To be a semi-automated modeling, right? The ability to import RDF, XMLs, JSON, right? The ability to import PDFs, Word docs in Excel, and to do entity extraction from those, algorithmic mapping, to essentially project domains from source data, right? So we knew that we wanted to do that rapidly because sort of implicit in your question was that, like, there's, people are like, oh, it would take me too long to model things, right? And now with generative AI, you have another bootstrap for modeling, right? So now we just have the latest thing. Again, it's not perfect, and I wouldn't run my domain on a generative AI model without some curation. But the idea is to leverage the best of both worlds, to take inputs from whatever sources customers have, use those to bootstrap the development of a model, also allow for manual creation of by solution architects or enterprise architects. And then importantly, the way we built our models is not only are we declarative, but everything's fully immutable. So our model, so when we build models in enterprise web, these graphs, the whole graph is immutable, right? In other words, it's persisted as a singular object, which is actually a composition of a lot of graph objects, right? Every node in that graph is also an object, and it's immutable. So we have the full change history of everything in that model forever. And we do that in a very lightweight way. So it goes to the management question. So one question is, we look to model very quickly. We often do POCs for enterprises worldwide, I mean, large Fortune 500 companies, and we'll do it in like 3 to 5 days. So we can model a domain fairly rapidly. And then obviously for a full production implementation, we might be going into weeks and months. But we could prototype things within days to weeks and deliver production systems in weeks to months, that are doing real mission critical enterprise automation stuff in a very sophisticated way. But the idea was to, because I've only worked in an enterprise context, and that's sort of my bias, is that I always, and I've been a business guy, and that's part of my bias, is I do want controls over things, right? I want version control. I want reliable messaging. I want transaction guarantees. I want state management. I want all those non-functional concerns to be addressed. So when we built the graph, we made sure that the graph was under management and it was under control, so that it was operationally scalable, not just scalable from a functional perspective, but it would scale operationally. I could deploy these things very quickly. It would allow me to maintain and manage the graph over time. I can version control the graph. I could see the provenance of every node that I've added, its changes over time. So it had an it has an explicit form of lifecycle management built into it as well. How's that sound?
That is really helpful. And as you were talking, I'm thinking about all the problems with enterprise data and how it lacks that kind of versioning and provenance and reliability, trustworthiness. And so when it comes to generative AI, there's a trust issue that arises with this public data that's being used to train the models. And so I'm wondering what your approach is along those lines.
So generative AI is obviously a very powerful new technology that's in a very nascent stage. So I don't want to be dismissive of it. I think what I don't see enough, and I know Alan, you're a thoughtful guy, so I think you look at things critically. But you know, in today's media hype age, and particularly the IT industry is just hype driven, right? People aren't looking at things thoughtfully as far as what is generative AI and what is it not, right? And to me, I look at it and go, okay, well, it's absolutely the world's most powerful natural language programming construct, right? That has ever existed, right? I mean, we've had natural language programming for a long time. In fact, in the past, I've worked with some of your colleagues in a different lifetime, right, on some NLP type projects that we did very quickly. But here now, the benefit is you can do almost this unscripted kind of NLP, right, where you can use the informality of language, and you can essentially, through the power of generative AI itself, its ability to, they call it semantics, but I think that's a really poor choice of words, right? Because it doesn't really understand anything, right? It's just making good statistical guesses at the order of words. But it is nonetheless very powerful. It actually has a fairly high success rate at the order of the worlds. It's not deterministic. It can't be fully trusted. It famously hallucinates. It's not fully accurate. It's not consistent. And there's all sorts of issues with the data that it's trained on. Concerns about actually protecting your own IP from your own models that you might share or expose to train it. Concerns about sharing your own activity data with it because you don't want that to be absorbed by any public LLM. And then you've got other pedestrian concerns like security. So once you get past the data trust things, and you have little pedestrian concerns like security, is this the latest way I'm going to get hacked by people hacking me through this model? Cost. Oh my gosh, the cost of prompts and tokens. I mean, when I hear people what they're doing with, you know, God, there's all these workarounds for its correctness right now, from, you know, RAG and all these things like GraphRAG, all these things like that. They're really very weak scaffolding trying to as workarounds on top of generative AI. And what they're doing is overloading those prompts and tokens. What they're not telling you is, well, when you do that, you're jacking up that cost just exponentially. Right. Because the more exchanges you have with the LLM, the more expensive it is, the more tokens in those exchanges with the LLM, the more expensive it is. And by the way, of course, the more you use that LLM, you know, the more resource and energy consumption. So, which are costs, but also they go against everybody else's sustainability initiatives. I mean, only a year ago, sustainability was one of the hottest topics. And now it's all said like with generative AI, let's paper that over. Nobody really cares. You know, we're draining lakes and burning down forests, and it doesn't really matter. And so it comes a question to like generative AI is really powerful. How can I use it practically in a way to leverage its strengths and mitigate its weaknesses, to minimize my costs, to minimize the resource and energy consumption so I'm still have a sustainable footprint. And maybe to actually even get better, maybe even more deterministic responses than what I'm going to get. And so it becomes a question where, like, what's the best use cases for generative AI? And is there a boundary where rules-based, logic-based systems can still do things much more efficiently at a far greater cost, at higher speeds, with greater accuracy, right? And these are not necessarily at odds with each other. It's almost like, can I bring these things two together? And that's what Enterprise Web has done. I could almost say that we were born for this moment, Alan, because we're fundamentally graph, and because we're an interoperability and automation platform, we can expose parts of our graph. We can train AI ops and ML ops, right? We can work very naturally because we can expose parts of our models to AI generally, analytic systems generally, as well as generative AI, and then take their inputs, their probabilistic inputs back as values as part of a deterministic transaction. And so Gen AI, the way we're using it, actually just pause. So does that make sense? We're always trying to find balance, right? It's a new tool. We're not going to discount it. How can I leverage that in a system where I know my enterprise-grade customers don't have infinite budgets? They actually do care about sustainability. They do care about security. They want to leverage this. They see power there, and we want to help them do that. But we're trying to take a balanced response to it. I'll go into some of the details there, but I just want to pause for a second.
Yeah, and I think it'd be helpful to walk through an example if you have one, so that we could just sort of evaluate the circumstance and how you're dealing with it.
So perfect. So, I mean, Enterprise Web is an AI-enabled no-code platform, right? So we use any kind of AI or analytics as inputs to support intelligent automation, right? That's our mission. That's our focus. It's our bias, right? We're looking to do enterprise grade web scale. That's sort of where Enterprise Web came from, or web style. And the idea was, how can we leverage generative AI? And our focus was, whereas most of the work on generative AI, I think almost exclusively, is what we're calling an LLM oriented architecture. Because by default, you're prompting the LLM, and no matter what you're doing to augment it, from training or tuning up upfront, or on the back end doing prompt engineering and or RAG or any other techniques, no matter what you're doing, your prompt is to the LLM and the output is from the LLM. Everything you're doing around that LLM in an LLM oriented architecture is just to incrementally improve the accuracy of the consistency of the results, while minimizing hallucinations. And we call that an LLM oriented architecture, right? That's pretty much what we see everybody doing, right? With chatbots and everything else. And it gets them, and for some use cases, it's phenomenal. I mean, there are tasks where, like, hey, if I had to do discovery as a lawyer and somebody just drove a truckload of boxes into my room, right, and I was going to have a legion of lawyers go through, or paralegals read all those documents manually, right? God, I could OCR all that stuff and have Gen AI do the first pass. That might be very powerful, right? I wouldn't trust it as the final word, but I'd still be like, okay, well, it's a brute force. It's a technical automation response to what would have been a brute force manual effort. And those kind of summarization things, I think, are very powerful. I think some of the things with just queries, I think, are helpful, because I think in some ways it overcomes the data lake problem, where you could actually combine it with graphs and vector DBs, and you can now actually be trying to do some advanced queries and analytics over structured and unstructured information. I think that's powerful. Again, my mission is enterprise grade mission critical automation, where, like, safety and correctness matters. So what we decided is to take a different architectural approach. We actually have what we're calling a domain oriented generative AI architecture. And what in this domain oriented Gen AI architecture, we're actually saying, let's just use the LLM for its highest and best strength for natural language. And we're going to use it as a natural language interface alongside our UI, alongside our API. And now we just have Gen AI. So now we have a third interface. We didn't change Enterprise Web at all. We leveraged its design because it was very easy. it's still one graph underneath, and we're just exposing that graph essentially through a UI, an API, or generative AI. And what we're doing is we're, instead of having the prompt and the response come from the LLM, the prompt goes into the LLM, but the response is coming, is being processed in the back end by Enterprise Web. Enterprise Web is using its domain knowledge, right? It's using the concepts, types, and policies of our ontology to provide the context to ground not only the query. Or, now, this is because now we're talking about a back-end system. This is no longer a prompt, Alan, right? It's a request. It's a request to a back-end system. And since a request doesn't have to just be a query, it could be a query and a command, right? So you can now talk to Enterprise Web through the Gen AI, just like you were always able to use the UI and API, but now you could talk to it, which of course lowers the barrier to use, it lowers the barrier to training. It's just obviously more facile, human intuitive interface. But essentially, you know, the generative AI is kept arm's length from Enterprise Web. We're really using it in this very minimal way to, whether you speak to it or write text into it, it gives us a text, right? It outputs a text. That's what generative AI does. We feed that into a vector database because, and we use the vector database as an intermediary. Think of it as almost like a firewall between us and the Gen AI. We don't want Gen AI to ever touch Enterprise Web ever directly, right? It touches, it only interacts through the intermediary, which is a true separation of concerns architecturally. And that we happen to use one of our partners. They're called KX, KX.com. It's the high-speed vector native analytics DB. And for us, we use that because we have a great partnership with them, but we can actually very easily, it's very easy for Enterprise Web to program KX with a little piece of our model. We can prompt, give it a little piece of our model. We can put some rules in there, some policies, and we can put some triggers in there. And what it does is then it sits between us and the generative AI. In the case of generative AI, we partnered with Microsoft, and we're actually going to market with Microsoft. We're talking to customers around the world. We're using Azure GPT-4 service. Now, we can use, honestly, any LLM, including open source LLM. We could use any vector native database. We're not restricted. We tend to partner with best of breed. I think arguably OpenAI GPT-4 is still the most powerful LLM. Of course, there are now open source LLMs. There are small LLMs. There are, you know, there's all that. It doesn't matter to Enterprise Web. We would mediate that with our abstraction layer anyway, right? In other words, we just model those different LLMs, right? Right, as just as different endpoints for us. And right now we're working very closely with Microsoft. And we think they're here today. They'll be here tomorrow. Same thing with KX. But again, so we're on the sort of the outside is generative AI. We also with Microsoft has something called Jarvis, which is an NLP program. It's open source NLP, Jarvis. And then KX. KX sits in the middle. We've essentially programmed it. You can call that AI ops, right? We put a little piece of model with triggers. I mean, that's effectively when you take a model, rules, and triggers, that's an algorithm, right? And so but we do that with like push button, right? We don't do any, there's no coding, there's no nothing, right? We go in there, we press a button, we put a little piece of model in there to represent that domain. That's going to be the domain for that use case. Then what happens is on an operational basis, when you talk to generative AI, the text is going to KX. KX is using what we programmed it with, that algorithm, to essentially bootstrap relationships to what Enterprise Web's model, right? Enterprise Web has the full ontology, right? You couldn't execute anything with what we give to KX. It's just a little bit, right? It's just a bit of our model, very high level abstracted concepts, types, and policies. And what they're doing is it sends to Enterprise Web essentially queues, right, which get mapped up to our ontology, right? And then Enterprise Web's resolving those queries and commands into actual executions. We either return a response to a query, or we take a physical action and update the UI, And what's really cool about that is not only were we grounding that whole interaction in context, we're doing that in a way that's safe and secure because we're arm's length from, so the IP concerns are gone, the copyright concerns are gone. We're only using it for specifically for the NLP conversation. All the domain is running an enterprise web. The domain can be managed by the customer. So the domain is local to the customer, even if it's in their cloud tenant, but it's the customer's local domain. The domain is a real-time domain, right? So all updates are realized in real time. That's not true in Gen AI, right? It's often 3, 6, 9 months, a year old, right? All enterprise web's responses are in millisecond to microsecond speeds. That's not true in generative AI. It could take 30 seconds. Right? Well, 30 seconds. Well, a lot can happen in 30 seconds, right? Enterprise web is a real-time system, right? Essentially, we use graphs to essentially take all queries and commands and respond in interaction-specific contextualized payload, right? So enterprise web is essentially puts work in context, right? That's what we do. We use the graph to contextualize every interaction in real time at speed, and then we maintain the consistency of the database, we maintain the transactionality quality, we maintain make sure that everything's deterministic. So we're making it safe, we're making it accurate, right? We're making it low cost. We run on x86, by the way, so does KX. So we're taking processing from GPUs, we're taking pro and so we're minimizing the prompts and the tokens and the expensive processing on a GPU. We're doing all the grounding and back-end processing on x86. We're Intel partners as well, by the way. And we're doing that on x86. So now we're hyper-efficient and we're sustainable as well. So it goes back to our view of trying to give our customers practical solutions so they can operationalize generative AI today in a thoughtful architecture, not some random scaffolding, right? Because that's what I see around generative AI. You know, is everybody's trying to just do everything to mitigate, like, oh, if I can only improve it, you know, get a 0.5% increase in the accuracy. What? Okay, but you know what? You can spend millions of dollars trying to tune that generative AI, and you still never get to a deterministic system, right? You still never eliminate hallucinations, right? You can get so, you know, it still remains what you're doing is improving. You can't fundamentally change what generative AI, which is, you know, Bayesian statistical probabilities, right? You can get better at a cost. And then the question is, what's their ROI? And last time I checked, businesses still care about ROI, right? Return on investment. So it's one of those things. So, you know, you've known me for a long time, Alan, and we've always tried to be. Through all these hypey trends that you and I have seen, right? We've seen them all come and go. And is that we've is enterprise web, I hope you share this view. We've always tried to be like, you know what, my duty is to the enterprise. The enterprise is a level-headed place. It needs certain things to be secure and governed. It needs these things to be operationalized and industrialized so they can use them with high confidence. And that's what we're doing in Gen AI. And I will say there's another thing that Gen AI does for us that actually is great. If you don't mind me going off for one more second, because I just
Yeah,
want
sure.
I don't want to forget, is that the one thing that I love about Gen AI for us is enterprise web is at a, you know, again, it's automation, integration, it's orchestration. Generative AI, because it's natural language and people have an expectation of almost a real-time conversation, really shows off the sexiness and power of enterprise web, right? Because we're responding back to it. You're literally having a conversation with your back-end systems in real time. And so it's almost, I would call it the apex of declarative computing or the apex of intent-based computing, where you're talking a system, the system understands what you're saying. And if it doesn't understand, like if enterprise web, we don't understand what we're saying, if we can't translate it in the ontology, we'll just say, we misunderstood you or we couldn't quite understand. Could you restate it? Or were you trying to say this? You know, enterprise web will essentially come back with feedback. We won't take a query or command we don't understand at the outset. But if we do understand it, we're going to drive it down to something. We're going to actually say, okay, we think you're asking for this. You're trying to design a service. We've constructed the topology for you. We're going to handle the integration. We're going to handle the configuration for you. Do you want us to deploy it? Is this what you wanted? And then we're going to deploy it and that whole process. And then we're going to assure it to you and say, look, your service is deployed. It's running. And we'll be fully transparent. It'll be there'll be a full audit log of everything the system did. We'll have gotten the customer validations all along the way. So in a way, generative AI over a conventional UI or API is just, there's just really no better way to say it. It's sexy, right? It's just, it's a super powerful demo because people just go, wow, this is, they can see how transformative that customer experience could be.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, I interviewed the folks at Schneider Electric who do a lot of data center infrastructure work.
Okay.
And so they're dealing with the fact that these GPUs and these GAI oriented data centers are, you know, just incredibly power hungry and generate a lot of heat. So these server racks are now water cooled in these GAI data centers. And so it just underscores the wastefulness of the the approach that you described earlier. That so much of this, if it were better designed, it would be unnecessary. Yeah. But the thing about it is, okay, so you want the conversational interface, and you want the implicit intelligence of an interpreted response to your query. How do you get that without wasting a lot of energy in your case?
So it goes into enterprise web systems and methods at that point, right? I mean, how does enterprise web perform at that speed, especially when we're so abstract, right? I mean, enterprise web is fundamentally an upper ontology, right? That would be almost defining the physics of enterprise web, which is loaded with generic enterprise concepts, like what is an organizational unit? What are people, facilities, locations, right? Which are universal across domains. And then systems concepts, like what are types, what are protocols, what are formats, right? And like, you know, what's JSON, what's XML, right? Enterprise web just understands all those at the upper ontology level, right? So it's a generic knowledge of the enterprise and generic knowledge of complex distributed systems. And then below that is a domain model, a graph domain model, right? Which we either provide for the customer or for the industry, like we do in telecom. We have a rich out-of-the-box, ready-to-use, standards-based, graph-connected domain model, or we can rapidly build, like we just did one for banking recently in like 4 days. And then underneath the domain model is domain objects. And those domain objects are also defined as graph. They're abstract objects. They're defined as graph. This is all germane in the sense that, well, it's actually all graphs all the way up and down, right? It's an upper ontology defined by graph. It's a domain model that upper ontology supports the definition of a domain, right? So you can actually call the upper ontologies almost like a DSL for DSLs, right? It's a domain language for creating domain languages, right? That's exactly what it is in a modern context, right? And then the domain objects are graph domain objects. And the beautiful thing is, well, actually, to enterprise web, it's just one graph. They are logically, architecturally, we have these layers. That's a layered architecture for comprehension and management and all those kind of things. You want those boundaries. But actually, when I'm processing it, when I'm executing it, when the enterprise web runtime is executing it, it's actually able to flatten that graph really quickly. And I'm sorry if that clap just came out really loud for your radio listeners, audio listeners. So enterprise web, and this is, we have 20 awarded U.S. patents on how we work with graphs for complex distributed systems, including patents filed on generative AI, et cetera. But essentially, instead of, let's say, semantic web, RDF, or LPG, labeled property graphs, right, which are essentially pre-computed graphs, right? They are a graph data structure. Enterprise web is projecting graphs, right? Out of key value. So enterprise, and that gives us the most flexibility, right? We're really what you might call a hypergraph, right? So we just have abilities to manage hypergraphs at scale. And the advantage of that over semantic web and label property graphs for our business purpose, again, I'm not knocking those technologies. We can actually work with them. It doesn't really matter to us. You know, LPG and semantic web have been more open world. They've been more about data interoperability, data analytics, recommendations, and things like that. Enterprise web is about automation, right? We're about using graphs to do contextual intelligent automation. So that drove a different kind of implementation. One thing that also distinguishes our graph because is that we, when you want to do complex objects in RDF, you have an explosion of triples, right? And so you have this problem where actually the one with one-to-many relationships, you have these explosions all over the place. Where enterprise web, our approach to that actually makes it a lot easier to have complex objects, complex processes, complex coordination, complex transactions, all models as graphs because of the way we handle the one-to-many relationships, the way we process the graphs themselves. So I guess in short, the way to say it is, and I think for some of those who are quite technical in graph, and I know some of your audience will be, I think I've given some popcorn trail there to so they can understand, have some insights as to how enterprise web is running. But to make it a little bit easier, is essentially enterprise web's runtime in when you're designing things in enterprise web, when you're designing your domain in enterprise web, or onboarding enterprise objects in enterprise web, in the background, effectively, you're encoding graphs, even if you don't know it, right? We make it super easy to do. If you're doing it through the Gen AI UI or API, we don't graphs sometimes are hard for people to comprehend. So it's just the way that enterprise web is recording it in the back end, is encoding it in the back end. So we sort of the graph is there and people can view the system as graphs, but for a lot of people that's a little too abstract for their liking. So in our through our interfaces, we make things a little bit more accessible for the end users, and then they can explore graphs to their heart's content. But so when you're doing anything in enterprise web at the design time, you're effectively encoding in graph, and then our runtime is executing those graphs, right? It's decoding those graphs, right? So now you could be a user of our system and you could have no idea that there's even graphs behind it. You don't have to have any knowledge of that, right? It's just the way that we're running in the background. I think for enterprise architects, solution architects, IT architects, for computer scientists, for people who really understand this stuff, they understand the power of that design, right? That it's a design that supports real-time contextualization of every interaction. It's a design that supports change over time. It's a design that supports extension because graphs are inherently flexible, extensible, and adaptable. So we're leveraging all these great properties of graphs, adjacency, and all right, all these powers of graph, we're using them for our business mission, you know, on for intelligent automation. So, you know, so hopefully that made sense. I don't even, you know, I think we've had some of those discussions, Alan, but I hopefully I shared something new as well today.
Yeah, it's really helpful to have that out on the table because it really is a thoughtful approach to doing things in a very useful and efficient way. I was thinking more on in terms of like the Microsoft side of GPT-4 and the computational load that you might be incurring on that side of things when you're using a GAI approach. And I'm ignorant about, you know, are you consuming a lot of power on that side of the equation, or are you how are you minimizing that cost?
Well, we minimize it, but just by virtue of, by the way, we keep it arm's length and we use it only for NLP. So in other words, you could use an out of the box general and Gen AI model like GPT-4 without any special training, without any special tuning, because the domain is in the back end, right? All the processing is shifting to the back end. So the only processing, so and to be clear, remember, we already had a UI and API. Adding Gen AI doesn't change our platform. It just adds a new kind of conversational interface adjacent to the API. And what's actually really cool about the system is you could be in our system and you could be doing all three. You could literally be talking to the system. the system, when you talk to the system, could be updating the UIs right in front of you. Then you could actually then resume navigating through the UI traditionally, do some configuration or something through the UI, then say something to the platform. It's going to take that latest inputs, but because the Gen AI, the UI, and the API are all running off the same graph in the background, they're all connected to that same graph. It's the same shared state space.
Mm-hmm.
They all read write the same thing, right? You call that in software, you call that full round tripping. So No matter what you're talking through, Gen AI, API, UI, you're writing back to the same graph. You're writing back to the same state space. So the next time you ask or query the system or make a command to the system, it's fully up to date on what you did through the UI. It's not lost on it what it did. The system is aware. But all that's on the back end. We're really only using Gen AI. Remember, an untrained, just normal, out-of-the-box generative AI interface, because its advantage is it's trained on the whole darn World Wide Web at a moment in time, right?
Yeah.
So what it really has done by brute force, you know, it has that mathematical analysis, of the embeddings, right, to actually sort of put words in orders and translate things really well. So it actually can translate to the text file very efficiently. And that's it. That's all we use it for. Give us the text file, right? It's not actually doing any processing other than giving us that text. And then on occasion, enterprise web also, we use it to talk back to the customer, right? It's a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So enterprise web goes, okay, great. I got this thing. And maybe I have a question back for the user. I want to tell them verbally the next thing they can do. Then enterprise web will just go back through Gen AI. But we're really using it, again, just for NLP at that level. Now, we can use, to the extent the customer wants to, we can, you would call this almost like dialable consistency, or right? Is to the extent that a customer wants to actually have the Gen AI do more, do some more abstract thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of doing structured, because enterprise web is, we're the traditional AI, the old AI, right? We're logic based, rules based, right?
Right.
We're
which is complementary to the statistical machine learning approach.
100% complementary, right?
You
just look at it and go, it's the bridge. In fact, you go, actually, enterprise web is we're going out of our way to bridge it, right? We're actually saying, okay, we got the deep learning models, including all the neural languages, neural network languages, all the NNs, right? The ANs, GNNs, all those things like that, right? And which are essentially what? Unlabeled, unstructured, unsupervised, right? That's their whole raison d'etre, right?
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, when deep learning was first conceived, the whole point was, hey, that old AI, it's useless. We don't need that anymore. It's too time consuming to do that kind of stuff. We're just going to do everything brute force through these neural networks, and it's going to be, completely displace you. And I think the reality is not so much, right? I think that the reality is, you can go a certain distance and it'll improve over time, right? No doubt. But you want to take those the neural network languages, the deep learning, combine it with that sort of older approaches to what were originally expert systems, right? Knowledge graphs, graph-based ontologies, logic-based programming, right? Those kind of older ideas, the old AI and the new ideas, essentially you're getting, which is called symbolic AI. I know that, right? So you got the neural network. So you got, essentially you bring the symbolic AI together with deep learning and you essentially get neuro-symbolic AI.
Yeah.
And that's what enterprise web's doing. Now, for the most part, to achieve the benefits we've discussed, we're maintaining a really clear separation of concerns. We're really going out of our way to mitigate security, first and foremost, IP and copyright, cost concerns, and sustainability concerns. So we do that by doing everything on the back end because, it's so funny that, you had mentioned that engineering company. I'm sorry. I just read an article about them. You were talking about,
Schneider Electric?
Schneider Electric. So Schneider Electric, I literally just read an article today. I'm like, maybe you wrote it. I don't know. But literally the person that's quoted there is actually saying, oh gosh, you know what? Sometimes this is just overkill and we don't need this. It's just a completely inefficient and maybe wrong-headed approach to solving a problem that I can solve faster, better, cheaper using symbolic methods.
Yeah.
And it's sort of funny, you don't see that in the tech media.
You don't, because they're not nuanced enough to really pick that up, or I don't know why they're not writing about it, but they're not.
Yeah, but that was it was great to see a business enterprise, you know, Schneider Electric, big company, to see an enterprise executive just acknowledge what it's the king's new clothes, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, Gen AI is awesome. I'm not debasing it. I'm putting it in context, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're making it useful for enterprise in the ways you were talking about. And I'm wondering in the remaining time, if we could sort of explore what you've been doing for particular industries. I know that you're deep in telecom, for example. And telecom, you know, just to go back to the beginning of our conversation with the componentization and the OSS, BSS environment that they started with. You know, how have you helped them along with an evolution towards something that is more functional?
Yeah, so a great, great question. And it's a good place to get out, right? Let's make this concrete for people. So essentially, you know, what enterprise web, you know, we talk about distributed systems, we're talking about, you know, services, application packages, right? All the elements of the things that people need to deploy them in the cloud, deploy them locally, processes they need to connect, right? Things they need to integrate with. We're talking about all those kind of things. And this essentially, you know, enterprise web is now offering and we've essentially been pioneers in telco virtualization and automation for a long time. And slowly but surely, we've been starting off with education, right? The power of abstraction, the power of graph, right? The fact that these things could drive automation was and give them greater agility and flexibility over their environments was the first things that we did, right? Going back almost 10 years. So we literally ran the first proof of concepts in the industry. There was a technical initiative by standards bodies called NFV, Network Function Virtualization, to take big, what were historically hard-coded telecom functions sold as part of big boxes, to extract those as software and then orchestrate them as software. And Enterprise Web did the first proof of concept of that, working with Dell and Red Hat and all these other big players. Then we were, you know, a few years later, we were showing how that could all be done zero touch, how you could actually compose services declaratively, deploy them fully automatically, and then manage them based on policies with no human intervention. So that was called zero touch network and service management, or zero touch service and network management, network and service management. Now what we've done is the latest thing we've done is plug it in, and I'll make this very concrete, is plug Gen AI interface over it. So now you think of telecom is just another organization. It has all the complexity. It has to struggle with all the distributed systems complexity that every other enterprise has, right? Now that there's cloud, it has to struggle with cloud, and it has its own struggles with, you know, hybrid multi-cloud, and of course edge. And except of course, you've got the scale of telcos, and the added complexity that they deliver the network themselves. And the network itself is now software. And so so this becomes almost a recursive idea, right? That, oh, wait, you know, things that you thought were physical and static and concrete are now very mutable and agile, and right, I could deploy a network on the edge, I could push a 5G core there, I could put the RAN there, I can like stand up the non-physical aspects of that, you know, all by software. And then I could push functions into there and start running business applications and IoT applications. And we could do that in minutes. So I look at telecom as being a superset of enterprise complexity or a superset of cloud complexity, just because they have all the normal enterprise constraints, all the enterprise struggles to connect their processes, to connect their people, to connect their functions, capabilities. And they struggle with it just like the enterprise does. But they have that added layer of complexity, a superset of complexity, because they provide the network too, right? The network that's under the cloud, right? The network that the internet runs on, the network that the web runs on, the network, right? And of course, the edge is going to be connected through those networks as well. And so now we're doing, we just won another telco award. I've got quite a loaded shelf here, literally just a month ago. for outstanding AI ML use case, and it was generative AI for enterprise-grade service orchestration. And we're able to demo, and we're now doing POCs for telcos around the world with intent to deploy production systems, that where a customer who has no understanding necessarily of what 5G is, right? I mean, you probably have heard the word 5G, I'm sure, and you have an idea of what it is, right? But most people don't really know what 5G is or what it really means, right? Like generative AI itself, right? So most people don't really know these technologies. And so a business customer without really an understanding, they don't even have to understand the cloud. They don't have to understand, right? That's the no whole notion and power of abstraction is that you can hide that technical detail. Is that an enterprise customer, what do they know? Well, an enterprise customer might say, realistically, they could say, you know what, I need a secure 5G gateway. I need a secure gateway. They might know what that means, right? They know what gateways are. They know what secure means, right? Clearly. And they could start with something as high level as that, right? They could use enterprise web as a front end for a telco and say, I want a secure 5G gateway. I want it configured this way. I want to deploy it in this cloud or that cloud or on this edge node, right? Or wherever I want it to deploy. And I want it to meet these SLAs, right? Something that you could actually state in 30 to 60 seconds, right? Enterprise web literally is constructing that service, like creating a service topology, like an enterprise grade engineering, a telco grade engineered service topology. That's a graph, by the way. What is a set of elements with relationships? It's a graph. Surprise. All distributed systems are, graphs. Surprise, people. And once you start connecting elements that connect flexibly based on events and policies, those are graphs, and they're best represented that way. And so, and behind the scenes, Enterprise Web is creating a graph, presenting that graph to the customer, saying, "Hey, is that what you wanted? Did you want something like this?" And you can say, "Oh yeah, I want to add this firewall." Boom, it adds this firewall. "I want to add this. I want to configure it this way." You're having this interactive conversation through the power of Gen AI on the conversation side, but Enterprise Web's the one that's actually translating it to the domain knowledge. Like, we know what a 5G gateway is, right? We know what a firewall is. We know how those things relate to each other. We know the constraints, right? We know what cloud means. We know what the customer's domain looks like. So if it's going to deploy in one of their environments, we know what their target infrastructure looks like. We know what the compute resources are available there, right? We know all of that in the graph. So the customer just has to say, "Yeah, I like this. Please deploy it on the network." And
Yeah,
after the
that's really an outstanding, and it's a really helpful explanation. And it occurs to me that you've got this persistent knowledge layer that you've built for the industry, and it's useful. I mean, once you've got that persistence, and you're just sharing it out to all these different carriers. How many carrier clients do you have at this point?
So we have global, right? So
Yeah.
we're working globally, and we work through channels. So we work with partners like Red Hat and Intel, and Microsoft and Amazon AWS, right? System integrators like Tech Mahindra and others, right? So we work with a lot of different players. So we go through these channels to deliver our solution because the channels bring us the boots on the ground, right? We're focused on technology. Enterprise Web is a hardcore technology company delivering platform solutions, right? We work with our partners for service delivery. But yeah, you could almost look at it as like this persistent knowledge bus, right? That the customer can maintain, that's always accurate, it's always up to date, right? Those are
And
thoughts.
you're using agents to help keep it up to date.
And we have our own implementation. So Enterprise Web is completely developed out of Enterprise Web, right? There's no third-party technology in there. So yeah, we
No, but
use
I mean in terms of software agents.
our own software agents internally. And essentially, Enterprise Web is fully constructed out of agent. It's actually a graph interpreted by agents. And that's it. That's why our footprint is only 50
And
megabytes.
it seems like the successful implementations of Graph, certainly in a large infrastructure context, are all architected that way. I mean, it just seems like that's got to be the way it's done, or it
Yeah,
doesn't scale well enough.
and I think that there's absolutely, and I think there's the challenge is there's different kinds of implementations of graph too, right? A lot of people, I'm sorry, of agents. So a lot, so people, and that's where you use the word nuance, and that's I find a lot of people don't want to put the work in, right? Like, generative AI has a lot of nuance. Graph has lots of nuance, right? These are not black and white fields. Agents has a lot of nuance. These are rich fields over decades, right? Right. And people want to just like simplify. And a lot of what people do with agents is essentially actor theory or microservices, right? I mean, they're just like essentially an agent is it really almost becomes a component that you could push certain analytics through. And then you try to make it so that your agents could communicate, collaborate some way. Enterprise Web has sort of a different and I think a unique approach in the sense that enterprise web agents are all generic. Every time there's an enterprise interaction, enterprise web, you can almost think of it as like a hive mind, right? These like we you call the system. The system's actually stateless. Enterprise web is a stateless system. It has when nothing's happening, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're for your customer, and there's nothing really going on or not too much. Enterprise web goes down to a warm start. It occupies almost there's no long running threads. There's no right. There's no stack running or anything like that. An interaction happens, or 1,000 interactions, or 100,000 interactions happen, and enterprise web scales out horizontally. And what happens is agents are dispatched, right, to interpret that interaction against the graph, right? And these are multiple agents, right? And these agents are coming, essentially, the agents are self-organizing around the needs of that interaction. So the interaction comes in and says, "Oh, I know who Alan is. I know what Alan is asking for. He's asking for this object that was the subject of the request. He's asking for this query command against that object. We know all these things about Alan. We know all these things about that object, right? We even know where you're calling in from, right? We know what format device you're coming in from. We have all this context that comes right in from that interaction in the first moment. We use that to bootstrap into the domain model, right? To understand what is it really Alan's asking for, and then we filter it based on security and identity. Well, what Based on what Alan's asking for, filtered based on his role and permissions, right? This is the subset of context that Alan gets to see or will use to interpret his response. So it's all filtered by ABAC and RBAC on demand. And then the agents are essentially, think of these as ephemeral agents that are coming in like thousands of them, right? All self-organizing, right? They're just an explosion of agents that are saying, okay, I'm going to do this integration task. I'm going to do this orchestration task. I'm going to do this process task. I'm going to do this configuration task. And they're all being dynamically dispatched, configured, and coordinated by our platform, which is then building up a log in memory, right? And all of that's going down at millisecond speed, right? And so the way to think of it is the agents are dynamically constructing a pipeline. It's not a fixed pipeline, it's not an imperative data flow. They're dynamically constructing the workflow to solve the to essentially to respond to your request based on the real-time interaction context. And that's what Enterprise Web does for every single interaction at scale. Agents.
And it relates directly to this buzzword, digital twin, that the GE was behind when they were talking about modeling gas turbines, for example. And the situation has been that the digital twins, so-called, they aren't modeled in an interactive way as you are. So they're not functional in the way that you've become as a resource and a platform.
I think part of it is we started off, and as you know, I mean, I think hopefully two things. Hopefully, Alan, you've known me for a long time, and it's becoming easier to understand my story. B, and of course, you were a smart guy when I met you. But also, the second part of it is that the industry has evolved over a lot, over this period of time, where I think the things that we're now describing are more intuitive to people, where 10 years ago, people were like, "What? You're doing what? And how are you doing it?" Right? Like, graphs, agents, what? dynamic data flow pipelines to contain what? You're but like we're like, hey, just look at the capabilities. If that, if you know, look, it's easy to use. The whole point is we're making it easy for you to use, scale, and manage. The whole point of a declarative system is to extract that complexity from you. You don't have to understand the physics of enterprise web to leverage its benefits. But yeah, you're right. A lot of people have built, and I think that's just the nature of the way people are reactive, and they build things to solve one problem, not realizing they created their next five problems, right? And when
Well, I go to these augmented reality, virtual reality conferences just to keep up to date on what they're up to. And it's like there's there they really aren't most of them aren't aware of the kinds of things that you're doing. And
it's um
because they're focused on the front end. They're focused on the presentation layer primarily. A lot of these people at these conferences. And they're not really thinking about the back end. They're sort of assuming the back end is going to take care of itself, and it doesn't for the most part, unless
It
you really.
does not. There, even with, like, if you look at like the generative AI experimentation going on with agents right now, at some level, again, if you don't care about correctness and safety, sure, there's plenty of agents out there that are doing some interesting things at high expense to fix your calendar and do all sorts of things like that, right? And that's cool. But if you're talking, none of those things are going to be enterprise grade, right? None of those things are going to be safe and secure practically scalable from an operational cost perspective and efficiency perspective. But just based because architecture is prologue, right? I mean, you could look at the design choices and go, oh man, you're never going to be able to do this, right? Architecture brings affordances, right? So I've learned to be able to like just read a solution just by looking at its architecture and saying, okay, well, you could do these things, but you'll never do these things because your default assumptions have it left out all of this complexity, and that complexity is going to be a wall for you. Enterprise web, essentially, we address both sort of the domain modeling problem and the implementation problem using graphs in one holistic approach. And I think that was, and so it's a unified theory, right? And I think that's partially because we were grounded in computer science from the get-go. My colleague Bill, our chief system architect, and I found him through an academic paper. I've personally read hundreds of academic papers. The company, we spent the first couple of years literally not talking to customers, not doing anything other than working through abstractions and how this thing would come together, like literally how the physics of it to solve the problem that we want in the way we want to solve it. How will we best construct it so that this is a future forward platform? And I think, and I think that's the bridge, right? We didn't just focus just the data side. You and I have had so many discussions where, there's people who just look at data and that's all they want to talk about. There's people who talk about applications and that's all they want to talk about. Both are wrongheaded, right? Data and applications belong together, right? Data contextualizes processes, processes create data, right? Processes have implementations, right? They consume integration points. Well, you have to understand all of those are part of the context too, right? Because not only, because now actually, not only do I want to deploy the functional requirements of an application, I actually want to understand its non-functional characteristics as well. I want to secure it. I want to make sure it's efficient. I want to make sure it scales. I want to be able to move it if I need to move it. I want it to fail over safely. So we built with all those considerations. It was not an easy road. It took us more time to be thoughtful up front to think about how those things were done. But I think it's given us a lot of advantage.
Well, it's so good to hear that you all are doing so well now, and you're still on the same path, but you've improved in terms of how systems have evolved, and you've taken advantage of those improvements. So, a real success story here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. In particular, given our history and stuff like that, yeah, we're veterans of these distributed systems wars and the evolution of CS. So I think, if I boil it down to one thing is I think we just stayed true to a vision and we were disciplined and rigorous in our execution, right? We just were, and I think that's hard for a lot of companies, right, to maintain over time. They take shortcuts. They try to react to market to do something quickly, but not maybe not wisely. And that becomes a technical debt that they have to address later on, right? And but
Oh,
yeah, you know.
and it's just it's sort of nightmarish to think about the technical debt that exists and what we have to deal with as a result. So we're they're very thankful that there are folks like you that help us sort of get our arms around it. So Dave, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. It was really helpful, and I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy it.
Great. Alan, thank you. You had a happy Thanksgiving to you and your listeners.